Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David James Gonzalez, and I'm pleased to be speaking with the pioneering anthropologist and scholar, Arlene Davila, author of Latinx Art, Artists, Markets, and Politics, published by Duke University Press in 2020. Arlene Davila is professor of anthropology and American studies at New York University and the author of several books, including El Mall, The Spatial and Class Politics of Shopping Malls in Latin America, which was published in 2016, Culture Works, Space, Value, and Mobility Across the Neoliberal Americas, published in 2012, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, published in 2008, and truly still one of my favorites, the award-winning Latinos, Inc., The Marketing and Making of a People, which I believe was initially published in 2001, but re-released in 2012. Hello, Arlene, and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies.
It's great to be back, yes.
I was just reflecting, it's been almost like 5 years on the dot since the last time you and I spoke, which is about the re-release of Latinos, Inc.
That's correct. I believe so. Yes, I remember very well.
Quite a bit has happened. You've published a few books since then. I think since then I finished my dissertation and got a job.
Mm-hmm, correct, yes.
Working on my first book and just really appreciate the inspiration and the work that you do, you know, and your consistent work to research and publish on new and expansive topics. And the point today is, the topic of today is your new book, Latinx Art.
Correct. Yes. No, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this book.
Certainly. I'm hoping we can start by you just explaining the process of your, you know, how you went about deciding to write a book, you know, about Latinx art with this focus on the artists themselves, as well as markets and politics and how they intersect with it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Those of you who know a little bit about my work know that I've been working on issues of representation, culture, the political economy of culture, broadly speaking, from advertising to media to museums. So this was kind of like a natural topic for me, especially when before I turned to academia, I used to work in the arts a bit. I dabbled in that world. And also working with artists as activists in my book, Barrio Dreams, where I was working in East Harlem. So this is kind of a topic that I was kind of an observant, right? For a while, I felt like this is the book I kind of had to write, but I didn't kind of dare to delve into that world. I think before we were talking about the art world as this kind of like intimidating space, you and I kind of before we started to this conversation. And I think that perhaps that kind of intimidating space aura also kept me from delving into this, thinking that even though Latinx art is something that I had kind of observed, that I was not equipped to write about it, like all of us feel, right? But you know, part of being an ethnographer is part of like learning the codes of particular of those spaces where we that we study, whether it is going to developer conferences, you know, when I was doing the work on shopping malls, or conferences around marketing, right, with the people that are involved in advertising. This was a world that also necessitated me to learn the codes and kind of talk to the people that are part of that world. And what we do as ethnographers is kind of tease through, right, those codes, that and particularly challenge that idea that you have to be a specialist in order to be able to talk about the space. So I don't know if this makes any sense, but I also feel that as an anthropologist and an ethnographer, because my livelihood does not depend on the arts, I was able to be a better observant and more of a critical observant because I was able to pinpoint issues that people in the art world don't necessarily want to talk about because they feel that it compromises their issues of quality or their positionality or their ability to get jobs in the art world, such as issues of racism in the art, for instance. There were a lot of, or the market, the role that the market plays in creating value and aesthetic judgments. So I felt that there was a lot of issues that I had, that I felt that I was the right person to write about, especially because I was more of an outsider, and able to go there, able to dare to go there, able to tease through a lot of that, a lot of those kind of authenticating canons that keep us from exploring and criticizing the space, and that intimidate, but more than anything, keep us from really probing how race operates in this art, in this space.
Thank you for that. That got me thinking, particularly about, as we were talking about before we started here, I admitted that, you know, for me, whenever I see books on art, I feel intimidated just because I feel like I don't know anything about art, right? I don't feel I'm qualified to even read a book, you know, sometimes, and interview an author, you know, that's written on it. And what I found interesting in your comment there is both the intimidation within the art world, right? So, you know, you as an outsider being the right person to write this book because essentially it's, you can address the issues that are apparent, particularly to Latinx artists, particularly in regards to inequality and their place within, you know, the art world, but you can do so without the repercussions that maybe a, you know, an art critic or writer for a newspaper or, you know, owners of galleries, you know, might be willing to do so as publicly, right?
Yeah. I mean, there is these are spaces that are so much ruled by money and, you know, and elitism and class, right? They're so elitist, these spaces. And, you know, part of what we need to do is defetishize this space, you know, because, you know, artists all, you know, we're all artists, right? And art is not any other, you know, why are we not looking? And in fact, that was one of the questions that guided me to explore this topic in particular, how easy it is for us to summon ideas of Latinx workers, voters, consumers. You know, there's so many areas in society where we kind of like summon ideas of Latinx, right? Like, or through a bunch of other stereotypes. Yet when we think about the art world or creativity, we kind of stumble and can imagine Latinx art or Latinx creativity. What does that say about the value of Latinx culture when we cannot imagine, when we stumble to imagine Latinx art as a space, not only that it exists and that it's thriving, but that all of us should have access to? And I think it also has a lot to do with the ways in which Latino studies has developed, in that right now, when you think about Latinx studies as a field, you have a lot of incredible work interdisciplinarily in the history, in anthropology, in all fields. Yet to me, it was fascinating to see how in art history, Latinx studies was very underdeveloped. There are so few people that are doing dissertations in Latinx art in art history. In fact, that was one of the reasons why the U.S. Latinx Art Forum was founded within the College Art Association very recently. just to kind of like address the fact that within the College Art Association, which is the professional organization within art history, they didn't have panels on Latinx art. They didn't have a lot of people talking about this. So I felt like within the art as a field, right? This is such a white dominant space that Latinx art didn't have a space until recent, and that's a problem. So a lot of our inability to talk about this and to imagine that this is a space that is intimidating and that has nothing to do with us has a lot to do with the ways in which the discipline of art history has developed for decades now, where you have had where Latinx art has been totally on the margins, and therefore our ability to intervene in that space has been imperiled because of that.
You commented there that, you know, Latinx art itself is a space. And it starts to get to how you open the book, which is defining what Latinx art is and or who Latinx artists are. Like, what is it that defines art and artists as Latinx? Can you go a bit more into that and, you know, how it's what I appreciate what you do in the book, show how it's not something that's just obviously aesthetically apparent, right? Like maybe one would expect, right, that it would, Latinx art is supposed to reveal itself by just looking at it, right?
Absolutely. It's like the same, you know, I would respond by saying, you know, what is Latinx history? What is Latinx literature, right? Like, I think that a lot of this, so that's the answer, Latinx art, right? I think that these are categories that we develop to make interventions within archives and within canons where we are excluded. That's really all it is. Because we know that these are categories that are just the point of entry for larger conversations, right? Because when you talk about Latinx literature, you know, it has been able for us to imagine positions, right? Fields, book series. It allows us to intervene into that conversation of the literary canon, for instance. So imagine the same with Latinx art, right? It's a category that helps curators, archivists, museum educators, and people to imagine a place for including a population that has historically been marginalized, not included, or not recognized as American artists, or as Latin American artists, which is the dominant category around a lot of the conversation around Latin anything has been dominated, you know, within the context of museums and art history. So that's one of the points I make, is that, you know, it's refusing trying to narrow it to a particular definition or to a look, and instead for us to imagine Latinx art as a space to imagine and begin to address populations that have not been addressed in these spaces. Now, having said that, I particularly pay attention to the in-betweenness, right, of Latinx artists, particularly the fact that whereas any artist from Latin American background in the context of the United States is immediately recognized, you know, it includes artists that are born and raised with artists that are immigrant artists and all of that. I call particular attention to those artists that lack what I call national privilege, that have these diasporic identities that are not recognized here or there, and that makes them especially marginalized in the context of the art world, especially in the context of an art world that is so dominated by national references of value. And in particularly Black and Brown artists, the artists that haven't had the benefit of national institutional structures for validating their work, like and that's a concept of national privilege that I'm happy to talk about a little bit more later. It's so essential in that I'm trying to think about what are the variables. You know, we already in our community in Latinx studies are becoming more adept at thinking about colorism and racism in our community. But I think that it's also important to think about other variables too that can impact recognition or hierarchies in particular contexts or spaces of representation. And in the context of the arts, that, as I said, is such a national-centric space ruled by biennials, ruled by national art fairs, nation-based, city-based, city-slash-nation-centric fairs, and also national elites and embassies that are fueling and impacted and funding and sponsoring events and branding themselves in the global sphere. It really matters for the when artists in the United States, when Latinx artists may or may not be able to be branded according to national categories. So that's one of the things that I discuss later in the book. But the key point, just to go back to your question, is to refuse reducing Latinx art to an aesthetic or to something that could be easily identifiable, but rather to imagine it as a project of addressing, of inclusion, of troubling, and perhaps even a project of transforming the art world, right? Because I think that when we begin to foreground issues of race and racism in the arts that are so central, when you begin to include and think through Latinx artists, it is a potentially radical intervention into how value is created in the art world. How should, what is art? Where should it live? That help us think beyond those kind of objective centric and market centric definitions of the art world that many of us feel really alienates many communities, and that does not really represent the way that our artists and what artists produced, and that tends to exclude art that is more, I would say, more ephemeral, not object-based, that is not as easily commodifiable, or art that is aligned with social movements. I don't know if this rambling makes any sense here, but the point is what can we learn about the art world by thinking about Latinx artists, and what are lessons that could lead us to transformation and to structural transformation of this space that could benefit not only the inclusion of Latinx artists, but also make it a more equitable space for everybody, right? Which is ultimately what I'm hoping this book helps us do.
Yes, that's very helpful. I mean, it particularly helped someone like me, again, so, not in tune with, the politics and the structure of the art world. I mean, really likening the project, of developing, of Latinx art and artists and their space within the art world as an intervention, when we think of, what the Chicano, the Puerto Rican, movement, what those did, right, in the late 60s and 70s to create space, right, institutional space, right, in academia, to create space in literature. Artists, filmmakers, right, are trying to do the same thing, right? So I find it.
Absolutely. And that is, a great way of looking at this is, my book focuses on the visual arts because I wanted to particularly highlight issues of racism that played out in markets. I've always been very interested in how capitalism works and issues of consumption and capitalism basically, and the commodification of culture more broadly. But yes, it's important to also think about that, the arts have been central, to our history, right, at all levels. And I think that's something that we need to always, be more aware of. And I think that we're in a perfect moment right now in Latinx studies where, our work is so interdisciplinary, right? To begin to think more through the work of artists at all levels, especially when art history is not doing work in our artists, right? Especially when art history is so behind, looking at the visual history of our community, it's really time that anthropologists, sociologists, that all of us in all of the different, from our different standpoints, fill the void, and that's actually what's been happening. I think that the most exciting work in terms of Latinx art or writing about Latinx artists are not really in art history because there's so few people writing in art history. So, but for that, we need to create more linkages or opportunities where our community can learn about our artists. And if I could intervene here, I have to say that one of the reasons why I wrote this book had a lot to do with my students, because I was, you know, in my classes, I was kind of amazed that whenever you ask students to identify Latinx artists, they would tell me Diego Rivera or Frida Kahlo or Botero. And I was like, oh my goodness, nobody could ever think about a Latinx artist, right? And I was kind of like shocked to learn that, you know, nobody, this history is not taught, like, you know, none of us are ever taught our own history in schools, but especially the artistic history and the visual history, you're not going to see that. So that's another reason why I think it's so important that we begin to break through and begin to incorporate artists in a lot of the work we do, and promote their work and uplift their work. It's part of how do I say this? It's part of uplifting our community, period, right?
Well, certainly.
And I, when I said uplifting, I don't mean like as in the bootstrap, like but you know, in the ways in which, you know, we have so much talent and you know, part of what we're doing, you know, all of us in our work is it's advocacy work, right? And this is something that a lot of the people that I interviewed kept telling me, you know, gallery work is advocacy work, writing about our artists is advocacy work. All of this is kind of like advocacy work to ensure that new generations do not grow up not knowing about our history, really. Because this is, you know, another way to think about it is what are the histories and the stories that are being told that people do not know because they're not looking in the visual repertoire, right? Especially when our history is so not well-developed, the visual arts can become another archive for us to explore and for us to learn from about communities that, you know, that are not covering the archives, that are not covered in the historical record. So in other words, I could go on, but there's a lot of reasons why we should be looking at artists. And I'm just hoping that what the book does is kind of alert people to the fact that there's a lot of creatives out there that we don't know about and we should know about them. And that's why at the end, I also include this appendix. I don't know if you've noticed, right?
Yes.
The long list of like non-comprehensive list of Latinx artists that everybody should know. Because that was another thing that I, you know, when I was doing interviews, everybody's like, what are you talking about? Where are these artists? I don't know any of them. Who are you talking about? Right. And I felt like, wow, you know, that's very telling, right? So what the list does is that I'm hoping that it intrigues people into exploring and maybe make their own lists, right? Like who else is out there that we don't know about and we should know about?
Yes. Well, and thank you for including that appendix, that's right, of Latinx artists. That was really great, and it was just wonderful to just flip through those pages and see some names to me that are familiar, but obviously, I mean, I know virtually none of them, right? I'm not aware of them. And so that gets us to the issue of invisibility, right? Within the art world, I think several of our listeners can understand the challenge as we've been speaking about history and literature, that Latinx writers, authors, historians, have faced in breaking into those spaces. But help us understand, you know, the internal politics of the art world and the structure of the art world that makes it so difficult for Latinx artists, you know, to break through, to be visible, to get recognized.
Yeah, I would say racism and money. Racism first in the incredible assumption that Latinx are you know, forever foreigners, and that they're not considered central to the that U.S. American, you know, in parentheses, because we know America is bigger than the United States. But when you think about the, you know, our history and the American canon, right, that long historical exclusion, you know, not only of Latinx, but also African-American artists, except that with African-American artists, because of the racial history and the racial ideology in this country of, you know, bipolar, you know, black and white, there's always been a space for recognizing the marginal history of African-American artists. Museums, university museums were central to that history, and there's a lot of African-American art historians and a whole infrastructure, in fact. I refer people to the work of Patricia Banks, who has done incredible work in highlighting the infrastructure of support for African-American arts that has led to the current Black art boom that people are celebrating today. But within the context of Latinx art, that kind of like forever foreigner, right, that is so central to the racialization of Latinx people in this country, has really hindered their incorporation in most American museums. So you have this kind of racialization where they're excluded in mainstream museums, but also they are excluded increasingly into a lot of the institutes that New Yorkers and Chicanx people founded in the 1970s. And that's another part of the story that I tell, but it's really interesting to explore the ways in which a lot of the institutional structures for creating alternative art, like El Museo del Barrio, for instance, Taller Boricua, a lot of these institutions also had limitations for Latinx art because of a variety of, I would say, capital-centric interests that also transformed a lot of the mission. You know, El Museo del Barrio is a classic example in that in the 1990s, as we know, it expanded a mission to represent not only Puerto Rican, but also Latin American art in the United States. So I think that the whole Latin America, the creation of Latin American art as a category, really was a key catalyst that also led to the marginalization of Latinx art, because a lot of the institutions that could have perhaps focused on advancing Latinx art, akin to how African-American institutions began to advance African-American artists, shifted instead to the more profitable, marketable category of Latin American art, which since the 1990s has been spearheaded by elites, embassies, auction houses, to the point that today many art history programs do have experts on Latin American art and do graduate PhDs in Latin American art, where you don't have, where you have maybe one out of every other year with an expertise in Latinx art. So in a way, what I try to do is bring attention to the institutional structures, right, that create value, whether it is art history programs, whether it is museums and the curators, the art press and the market. It is evident that there are institutional structures, capital interest, money, that have created and that have uplifted certain categories and not others. And that a lot of the thinking about what is valuable is very imbued with racist evaluations of value that has to do with, you know, what is regarded as more or less profitable. And ultimately, what I want to highlight, what I do is kind of tease apart that kind of like the mechanism of money and capital that fits in, that makes some categories more valuable than others, challenging the idea that this is a space where identities don't matter, and that is ultimately, you know, value is kind of like a magical thing that just happens that we should all recognize. I show that that's not the case, that in fact that magical idea of value around what is an artist that we should all look at is created by collectors, is created by patrons, is created by mechanisms that support some artists and some categories and not others. And that's why it's so important for us who are advocates for Latinx art, but also art Latinx culture, to create programs in Latinx studies, to create spaces to show Latinx art, why institutional spaces like Latino institutes, you know, all universities should have, you know. The older I've become, the more of a proponent I've become of the need for all of us who are a little bit more senior to, you know, to change the conversation and to try to invest in institutional spaces where that, that could uphold, that, that could uplift our community, not uplift our community. I hate this word, here it comes again, but showcase and support and create community, basically. And that invisibility, you know, and where that invisibility can be challenged and where that invisibility can be eliminated, we have so much work to do, basically, as you know, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, yeah, and it's such a great point because, I mean, I can understand your struggle with, you know, using the word of showcasing, right, or highlighting, right, lifting up the work, you know, that these communities are doing because, you know, in some ways, right, it can be used you know, against right, the project or the effort, people saying, oh, like you're basically just, you know, lifting up people you know, or right, kind of privileging some over others. But what your these chapters in your book really do is they explode the myth in that operates within the art world that the most successful artists or the most successful art that get the highest evaluations and whatnot are those that operate by the principle of they just speak for themselves, right? That is the quality of the work. It's the idea of meritocracy.
Oh my God, absolutely.
To the top, right? And which is completely false. I mean, that's what you show. You're just blowing this, the whole, you know, idea up that it's really about, it's about networks and it's about privilege and who has access to these spaces and, you know, who's getting trained in these programs, as you've already mentioned, you know, that makes them aware, right, of, you know, either styles or artists that creates genres. And within all those spaces, you have a complete ignorance, you know, of Latinx art and artists and spaces and people. And so, you know, we have to lift up these people and their work and their spaces and create the space, right? Because if we don't do it, the institutions themselves, the art institutions, academia, you know, capital, right? They're not going to just all of a sudden, you know, they're not going to see what they don't see. We exactly. have to make it visible, right?
Or they will see what they want to see, which is that which is more commodifiable, mm-hmm. and right, and what they think represents, you know, they're with the what would sell, right? And I think that that's I feel that, you know, we have a lot to learn from African American community in regards to you know, how this category of Black art and African American art, you know, it was decades, you know, of people patronizing African American owned galleries and really investing, you know, in Black artists, right? And I think our community, our Latinx community, you know, needs to be doing a lot of that. One of the most interesting things when I was doing the research was learning how few Latinx collectors are there, right? People that, you know, of course, collecting has its own, you know, baggage, right? In our community, you know, is regarded as this kind of like colonial category, you know, nobody wants to be a collector, you know, like, you know, we are stewards of, you know, of history or whatever it is. But the fact is that, you know, in our community, we there's very few people that are promoting our artists or buying our artists. And that's, you know, one of the reasons sometimes is because people do not know where these artists are, right? So what I'm hoping, and artists want to have audiences, you know, they want to ensure that they are, many of the artists I spoke to, they wouldn't know where to go to sell their work. And here, by the way, Instagram has been fantastic because Instagram has kind of democratized, in a way, a little bit of a lot of this kind of elitism of, you know, you have a lot of, and I write about this in the book, about how artists are challenging the barriers and the racist structures of the art world by actually, they're not staying put. They're creating, you know, they're creating new ways of creating audiences and creating spaces that are not necessarily galleries, for instance. And I think that ultimately what I'm trying to do is kind of imagine a more democratized world, a more open world, right? Where it's not only like wealthy people that buy work, but, you know, all of us, you know, can imagine being part of community of artists. And I think that, you know, reimagine the ways in which the art world functions so that we can stop this fetishism of you know, of galleries or art fairs, but that, you know, all of us, yeah, all of us can patronize artists, but that also artists can reach, you know, our community in ways, because that I also feel is another conversation from the standpoint of Latinx artists who gain some level of success, who are very concerned about the fact that they're not reaching the more success they have, the least connection they have with our communities, right? And we want to ensure that you know, this notion that only wealthy people can have art or the only wealthy people can purchase works, that we have to challenge that. We have to change the world, basically. We have to create more equity, and we have to ensure that artists also benefit from their work right now. I talk a lot about that, challenging this notion that artists do not benefit from resale royalty rights of their work. I talk a lot about the importance of ensuring that we change the way in which art is sold, so that it's not only collectors that benefit from resale of and the evaluation of the work of our artists. So David, there's a lot there, and I don't know. I just hope that my book becomes part of a larger conversation, and that I hope that maybe 5 years from now, people will read my book and say, "Oh my God, everything this woman described is totally passé," because Latinx artists are well regarded and we know about them and they're included in most museums, and most museums are very diverse, and we have all these curators that talk about all of these artists and all of these stories are being told. So that's my wish, is that when people read my book, they will no longer identify with anything I say, because the world would have changed. Yeah, that's kind of what I would love. That's why I wrote this book, so that it is totally passé within 5 years. Yeah, I would love that.
I would love it too. I mean, and I love the idea of, you know, that, and the goal and the hope that you have. I mean, it just resonates so much with me in the way I view, you know, the elite spaces of academia, right? I mean, the elitism within these spaces, I mean, it makes me sick, right? I love your phrase of, you know, democratizing the art world. And I think, you know, much of our audience is, you know, either, you know, tied to academia in some way, or has, you know, spent time in college and could at least find ways, right? We're in the business world, to, you know, see how that applies, how they've seen, right, how elitism functions in the different spaces of our world and our lives and our politics. And I think it's maddening for all of us. And a lot of what we want to do is figure out, well, what can we do about this, right?
Absolutely. Right,
you know, the role of the need for more critics. We need more critics, right, that are informed about Latinx art and artists that have been trained, right, in Latino studies, that have been trained in Latino history, in order to understand, right, and be able to interpret and see what it is these artists are doing. And in some ways, I mean, that's that's for the art that is maybe aesthetically, you know, guided or directed by that. I mean, others, you know, may not be, as we mentioned, you know, earlier, there's not going to be a single type, aesthetic type of Latinx art. But that you have people trained, right, in that field, in that background, that the need for, as you've mentioned, curators, the need for collectors. I mean, there's a role to be played by all sorts of different people in this, as well as
absolutely, yeah. I think it's also, you know, you brought the point of the elitism of the academia. You know, I totally relate to this because, you know, what I try to do in this book is also, you know, challenge these kind of disciplinary canons that only some people can talk about the art world. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, like, it's so ridiculous that we are, you know, in the 21st century thinking about the, you know, fetishizing disciplines and categories, you know, like the boundaries of anthropology, the boundaries of art history. You know, we have to challenge a lot of that, you know. Yes, these spaces give us jobs, you know, but frankly, they do not help us think. They do not help us theorize. They do not help us to be free. And I think that what we need to be doing right now is really cutting through those kinds of, you know, ideas that, and that's kind of what I'm writing this book. You know, a lot of people told me, oh, well, you know, nobody's gonna respect your book because you're not an art historian. And I'm like, I don't want this book to be respected. I want this book to be an intervention, right? And I think that we need to be free, and we need to be we need to think about what it is that we're writing for. I mean, right now I'm very excited about the Society for Anthropology, you know, the volume that's coming out right now on anthropology refusals by Gina Perez and Alex Rivera. Did I say his name right? From Notre Dame. They have this, you know, new collection of, you know, Latinx anthropologists who are going to be, you know, provoking a transformation of the discipline. Right now we have, that's exactly the kinds of conversations we need to have. It's like, how do we change, you know, the look of anthropology, who has access to, how do we ask questions about why are we writing what we're writing, right? Who benefits, and to push through the disciplinary boundaries of fields is just so important right now, particularly the elitism that comes with that, you know, with protecting boundaries. Maybe it's because I'm getting older. I'm getting more. I have less patience for that kind of, you know, conversation about, you know, disciplines. I have no patience for that conversation, the value. I have no patience for conversations of quality. And what this book does is hopefully help us be a little bit freer from those bounds of not only meritocracy, but quality and judgment, and hopefully, you know, get us to be more interdisciplinary in our work and in our practice.
Yeah, one thing I've been thinking about while we've been speaking is, you know, the impact that art has on, you know, there's so many of us. I mean, particularly those that are not, again, either trained or well read. I just, what I'm thinking about here is my own students, right? That last semester, you know, as our university was forced to shut down, like pretty much all others, as a result of the coronavirus, in an effort to try to kind of rethink some of the assignments I was asking students to do, which were no longer going to be feasible due to the lack of being able to, you know, present in front of groups and audiences. I gave the students an option to, you know, essentially define their own type of final project of how, in this class was a seminar on immigration history, U.S. immigration history. And what I asked them to do is, you know, think of a project in some way that where you could express either in written form or visual in some other way what it is you've learned in this semester, as we've essentially, you know, been discussing several very, very good books that are very recent in the field. And what struck me, and this is how it relates to our conversation here, is this was a class of about 18 to 20 students, and at least six of them, you know, chose to paint something. You know, they wanted to express what they learned visually through various types of paintings or artistic representation. Others used photography as a way to create a type of visual representation of ideas like assimilation and national belonging. It was amazing to me just how, again, creative they were and how just automatically several of them, because I didn't even come up with the whole art idea, but immediately when I opened up the door, they said, hey, I would love to paint something. I would love to photograph something. I would love to make some other type of artistic rendering. Just how many of them quickly, that was their reflexive response. That's what they wanted to do to express how they were, And it made me think of your book and of this call to, really how much, democratizing, the spaces where artists, traffic, the spaces where artists can present their work, display their work, the spaces where people can just be given the opportunity to say, it's okay, right, to represent yourself. It's okay to express yourself and what you know, what you've learned, what you're thinking about in this way, rather than just through words, rather than just through voice,
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's just beautiful.
And I'm wondering just a bit more, what it is you think that, and kind of speaking to that audience, right? To the listener, not tied to the art world, to the student that's listening. What are things that we can all do? That those of us that are, again, particularly not tied to this world, but what can we do to, if we feel passionate about this, we want to do something, what can we do?
Yeah, I always feel that, especially those of us who are working in institutions and that have access to research funds of any sort, there's always artists in our community, invite them to your classes, visit local organizations where you have arts. That's one of the amazing things is that, all of us are working with community organizations, this and that, but, most of them also do arts. So I think that's the key thing is like, I'm sorry, this failed. When I did that list of artists we should all know are people that either I came across or I knew. Imagine if you were to do a list like that, right? Of who are the people you're in conversation with that are artists that, and I think that's the key thing we could all do is like look around us, right? All over the United States, there are artists, are cooperatives, art-led organizations that need support, that need that you could link with and you could link your students with. So that's the number one thing is just to ensure that we have our eyes open to those community organizations that are working with local artists. And second, I guess do activism with your community organizations, mainstream institutions that are not showing Latinx artists. To me, it was fascinating to see how the LA community, the ways in which they got the MOLA, the Museum of Latin American Art, to open up to finally have Chicanx artists. I mean, imagine, right? A museum in Los Angeles that was focusing on Latin American art and had never had a Chicanx artist, right? In Los Angeles, right? It was a matter of activism, people writing letters to the board and insisting that the institution open up to Chicanx artists, right? I think all over the United States, we can look around, where what is the big player in our community, in our city, and are they showing Latinx artists, but also diverse artists? Are you showing Black artists? Are you showing bebop artists? Are you showing, what is your, to kind of like ensure that we make it into a project, right, to transform the ecosystem of the arts that surround us. And that means also ensuring that your newspapers, right, have journalists of color, writers of color. I'm in New York City, and it's kind of embarrassing that the New York Times doesn't have regular Latinx writers, the New Yorker, right? The magazine that influences so much of culture and the arts, it's in New York City. 30% of the population here in New York City is Latinx, and you don't have regular contributors to these major publications. So I think that all of us need to be very rigorous about the politics of representation and begin to foreground matter of institutional change and demand, right, structural transformations. And when we talk about structural transformations, we're talking about ensuring that these institutions look like they should, right, in the hiring practices, in the positions of leadership. So I think that those are the two things that I think we need to do, is not only highlight and begin to cooperate and promote the artists in our community, but ensure that the powerful players within your milieu, wherever that is, are put on guard and are warned that we're coming after them, you know, because this is the time to be making transformations, and it was going to require structural transformations, real structural transformations. So we, as anthropologists, as scholars, need to be agents of that.
I agree. Thank you for that. What are some of the, you know, things that you are seeing? I mean, you did quite a lot of travel and work, you know, for this book, right? Traveling to art shows, to museums, to interviewing curators, critics, collectors, etc. I mean, there's some really cool interviews you got as well, people you're speaking with. I think you got to speak with Cheech Marin, is that right?
Well, it was a fun interview, so yes.
I mean, he himself, right, you really push for the need for collectors, like at least in the way the art world works, right, in creating, raising visibility, creating value. I mean, really a lot of this is done by collectors themselves, and he's done quite a bit. He's one of the examples you mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's so important, you know, like everybody, you know, one of my biggest things is like, you know, there's a lot of Latinx people that have money, you know. Why they should be buying artwork, you know, they should be uplifting this. You know, I always wonder why we don't have like celebrities like J-Lo, you know, buying Latinx art, you know, like, you know, Black celebrities have been, you know, very famous about their collecting and their promoting of Black artists. So, but I think it goes back to the issue of value, right? Like we need to create that value, right? And the way we create that value is by beginning to invest in our community. And oftentimes, you know, in Hispanic Heritage Month, I was asked to speak to some financial people for Hispanic Heritage Month. And I actually went, I'm like, okay, well, you guys have money. This is your responsibility. You have to, this is where you need to be buying. This is where you need to be investing in. And you know what? I was surprised that a lot of them were like, oh my God, I didn't know this existed, right? And people were genuinely interested. And I think that, you know, a lot of our community at all levels, you know, many of us, you know, just like we're so excited about the Selena movie, you know, and we're going to all watch the Netflix series, you know, we all going to promote, you know, if we know there's an artist, you know, and we have a little money, you know, guess what, you know, you have a choice to buy art. Wouldn't you want to promote and have like a Latinx artist in your living room? So when people come to your house, you could tell stories about that artist and stories about the theme and the narration and the subject matter, you know, I think, you know, in deep inside, right, there's incredible pride in our community. And I think that all we need is to kind of ensure that we cultivate and we kind of connect to local communities of artists. And I think that I find that a beautiful collaboration, because, you know, our artists, they also want to be collected, right, by people that understand them and that respect them and that, you know, and that respect those stories, right? There is something really beautiful about, you know, when an artist and a collector, that when it's not about money or speculation, you know, about whether this is going to create value, but rather it's like, wow, I really can relate to this story. I can relate to this artist, right? We need to really cultivate those moments where it's anti-capitalist logics that permeate encounters and exchanges. And that's some of the other things that I try to do in the book, is try to recover those spaces, because, you know, we have to, because I refuse to imagine a world where the market eats all of the other ideas and imaginations that are contained in the space, because otherwise, you know, to me, it wouldn't be as interesting.
Yeah. I entirely agree. It made me think of, you know, you provide several examples, and I wonder if you might maybe as we get to close here, if you could, maybe this is the point to end on here. If you could provide some examples of, you know, the type of work that artists are doing, particularly within their communities. And you mentioned that so many Latinx artists have such a strong tie to their community. Many of them, you know, volunteer their time. I mean, they're either teachers or they work in local museums or they work in local schools or, you know, they're doing various things in order not just, and not just purely, as you're saying here, right? Not just to, you know, buy into the capitalist logic of, you know, they're trying to make money and promote fame, but they're, you know, they're trying to support their communities. They're trying to educate children and educate their communities of their possibilities. So I mean, are there any ideas or examples that come to your mind of, you know, either specific artists or institutions or things that you know, artists are doing on the ground themselves, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I also want to highlight that whereas it's true that many of our artists are activists too, and they're doing all this labor, unpaid labor. It's also very important to remember that artists also are workers, right? And they need to be paid, right? I warn a lot this idea of like asking artists for donated work for fundraisers and expect that they're there always to collaborate and amplify causes. We need to always try to ensure that we respect their labor too, right? And ensure that we always advocate for fair equity and to pay artists, right? Because labor, you know, they're workers, they're artists, but artists are also, they also need to eat, right? But I wanna end by shouting out the work of Chilin Rodriguez and Alicia Grullon. They're two artists from the Bronx that I talk about in my book, and both of them have been doing a lot of activism since COVID in organizing food drives in the Bronx around the community. And if anybody's listening and wants to support, they could donate to their initiatives. I believe it's called the North Bronx Collective, from which they're organizing a lot of the food drives. They have fundraisers Chilin has been doing beautiful drawings of essential workers that kind of amplify the need for really appreciating all the laborers that are keeping the city and the United States going in the midst of the pandemic. And Alicia Grullon has been doing beautiful interventions, kind of photographs, where she herself takes the persona of some of the essential workers to call attention to this workforce, but also to call attention to matters of equity, not only in the arts, but you know, in our service force. And both of them are they're also two artists that I think are brilliant, but also challenge the more commodifiable aspects of the art world. You know, they produce objects that are more ephemeral, right? Performance art or drawings or video that are not so easy to collect, right? So these are not artists that, like, you know, would be that are so easily that cannot sell work as easily, and therefore that are not as easily inserted on markets, is what I'm saying. But artists that are doing really incredible work and that make us think about, right, what's so exciting about Latinx art right now, which is that it's really at the pulse of so many incredible conversations, causes, but also that help us think about an art world that is not so reducible to objects and to things that could be purchased and sold.
I love that. Arlene, thank you for your time and your willingness to come on to New Books in Latino Studies. It's I'm chuckling to myself here because I know it's been about 5 years since the last time we talked, but it definitely doesn't feel like that. And just thank you for being so.
By the way, I wanted to correct something. You said that Latinos Inc. was award winning, and I want to say humbly that Latinos Inc. never won any awards.
Are you serious?
No, never. You may be confusing Latino Spin, which won the best book in Latino Studies in 2010, but I didn't want your readers to think that Latinos Inc. was award-winning. But although I appreciate your love for it, it's one of my favorites too. So thank you.
Yeah, well, shame on all the awards.
Yeah. That's right. Shame on them. That's right. But that's why, again, we don't buy into these notions of quality, right. Aesthetics, and criteria and prices. It's all political.
It's a war in my book. I'll say that.
Absolutely. Although I will be routing for your next book to be a prize-winning book, though. Okay.
Thank you. Well, thank you again, Arlene.
Okay. Muchas gracias. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.